and welcome to episode 53 of the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. I am Patrick Macias, the author of the Tokyo Scope blog.
And I am Amuro Ray, the pilot of Gundam. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not. I kind of wish I was. Sorry. I'm Matt Alls, the author of Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World.
Do you have Gundam on your mind? Is that what's going on here?
I've always got Gundam on my mind, but only first Gundam. I'm not into any of those later Gundam. Oh, no, I actually got called out on the internet recently for saying Gundam instead of Gundam or the other way around. And I'm like, it's Gundamu if you really want to get serious about this. So,
isn't it Oppa Gangnam Style or something like that?
Can I dance like a horse, like in a giant robot costume in front of somewhere?
Yeah, I found this clip on Twitter just today and reposted it. Tomino at the Gunhead press event talking on Japanese TV about Gunhead standing in front of the 1-1 scale Gunhead mech that they built. So I'll send you this link because he's in a real jovial mood because he's talking to like a young Japanese girl who's wearing like a military outfit.
He's a notoriously crusty, curmudgeonly, did I pronounce that right, individual. So it's always amusing to see him when he's in one of his bouncy moods.
Yeah, he's very Genki. Yeah, maybe that's when he came up with the name Quattro. What is it?
The names in the Gundam series, yes, Quattro Vegina, which is the, I'm not making this up.
Named after his father, perhaps. Hey, why don't we do a Substack article on our favorite wacky Gundam names?
Camille Bidan. There isn't actually my favorite Gundam naming is one of the space battleships in there is named the Radish. It's just rat. Like they all have these crazy names like the Argama or like the, you know, whatever. And then there's the Radish. It's like a giant space battleship named Radish. I've never managed to get to the bottom of why it's called that. It's not shaped like a turnip or anything like that. But
maybe the reason why Gundam has never been as popular as the Transformers is because they don't have cool names like Hot Rodimus or like Jazz.
Not nearly as good as the GoBots, which are like Sight Kill and Fight Tour. I mean, they were really like, oh shit, it's 5:30 p.m. Friday. I want to go home. We got to name these things quick, around the table. And they named them. But I love the GoBots nonetheless.
I feel like we're lost, but we should get back to the focus of what we're here to talk about today. And that is the Barbie movie tokusatsu or not, Matt?
You know, I actually, speaking of Substacks, speaking of newsletters, of which, you know, we should keep reminding our readers that we both individually and sovereignly do them.
We should remind them 37 times a day on average.
Did you know I'm doing a newsletter? Did you know I'm doing a newsletter? Did you subscribe? Did you pay? Anyway, the thing I really want to write about that I haven't yet is the fact that like Barbie, the original Barbie dolls were all made in Japan. Like they were made here in the 60s by like Japanese seamstresses, made each costume by hand. The bodies, the hair, God knows where that came from, were all assembled here in Japan. So she's like a real American hero, like G.I. Joe, but made in Japan.
I did not know that. Wow.
It's true.
No, this is not a conspiracy theory. This isn't like a congressional hearing to look into, like UFOs or something like that.
Well, Patrick, as I wrote about in Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World, available at a bookstore near you, the Japanese toy industry was one of the first industries to get restarted. I almost said kickstarted after World War II. And, you know, they were making a lot of domestic toys, but they were also making toys for export. And Barbie was one of them. So, doing outsourced stuff, just like how in the 80s, all of the, you know, Saturday morning, you know, cartoons were made here in Japan, even though they were a lot of them were of American brands.
Did they make the Kens in America because they're all American guys just like me?
You look like Ken. Wait a second. Does that mean you're all smooth down below the waist? Is that what you're...
No, don't take off my... No.
Is this a test of whether I'm a replicant, Mr. Patrick? Or I don't even want to, I'm not even complete this. My sister never played with Barbies as a little girl. So I didn't really have, you know, actually, I'm just going to put this on the table. I had a girly doll before my sister ever did because I had the Jamie Summers Bionic Woman doll the Fembot. Okay.
And Oscar Goldman. You had this, the Holy Trinity. Like, it's like they brought to the baby Jesus, like an Oscar Goldman, a Jamie Summers, and a Fembot.
The three women I admire most, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Did you comb her hair and make her pretty, Matt?
I had complicated feelings. You know, like I was team Steve Austin as a kid, and my parents gave me the female dolls because I watched, you know, Bionic Woman 2, and I was like...
Also, it was the 70s, right? Like Free to Be You and Me.
It was the 70s. And man, the packaging on those is like unbelievably... No CG design, no, like it was all done by hand. It's all really amazing. I did take off their clothes, but I was looking for robot parts. I swear
you were looking God. For exploding like briefcases and stuff like that, right?
Exactly. No, my, you know, so I didn't, those were the only girl dolls I grew up with because my sister was a My Little Pony collector. So a collector slash fanatic slash whatever you do with those. Are those Sofubi, Patrick? Do My Little Pony dolls from the 80s count as kaiju?
I hope so. Those had a strong connection to Japan too because of the cartoon. Wasn't that part of the whole Marvel Sunbow thing?
Toei Doga, did they do it? Yeah, Sunbow for sure. Yeah, Sunbow is the, for those just tuning in, Sunbow was Marvel Comics' Hollywood-based production company making all sorts of IP-licensed fare. I think their first thing was Transformers, the movie, wasn't it?
That sounds about right. Or maybe G.I. Joe. They all struck around the same time, and they were very educational because they taught you not to play with fire for like 30 seconds at the end of the episode or talk to
Don't
strangers
and stuff like
that. Don't
stick things in light sockets. Like the whole episode is about like G.I. Joe dropping napalm on like Cobra's base, but then the last 10 seconds were like, kids, you know, don't pour sugar in your dad's gas tank, because they needed to have some, you know why that was? They had to have the fig leaf of educational, all shows broadcast to kids had to have like some educational content back, you know.
This is all eerily mirroring where we actually are going to go with this episode now that we're done with our rambling. And that is our feature attraction. We lost a giant of Japanese animation this month. It turns out that Ippei Kuri, who is one of the founders of Tatsunoko Productions and one of the co-creators of lots of great classic anime, including Speed Racer, died on July 1st, but was announced a couple of days ago.
Wow, I don't know how I missed this. Ippei Kuri, man, that guy was like there at the, you know, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe, kind of like early, early days of anime getting broadcast abroad, right?
Yeah, he was born in 1940, so it puts him in the same generation as like Leiji Matsumoto, who also passed away this year.
Right.
So that's like two big, bright stars of that first like kind of golden age of anime and manga who are no longer with us.
Kuri Ippei to me was always kind of a more behind the scenes kind of guy in my mind. Like I knew his name. I know that, and I'm sure we're going to get into the productions that he involved with and that we all know. But like he was never, to me, correct me if I'm wrong, as kind of as forward facing as other creators like Matsumoto Reiji or like Tomino or Miyazaki. Would you agree with that?
Well, the thing is I actually met him. I actually hung out with him for a full day at his apartment in Kugayama, Tokyo in 2008. And he said, it was all my idea. Everything you see, that was me, baby. Number one. No, he didn't actually say that.
Anime, I made that. Me, that's who. No.
He claimed he was in the Beatles. He claimed he wrote Yesterday. Yes. Paul McCartney just ripped him off.
He was on the grassy knoll on that day in 1963. Wow. I can't believe you spent an afternoon with this guy.
Yeah, the Speed Racer movie from the Wachowskis was coming out, and my buddy who worked at Tatsunoko Pro said, hey, I got an idea for you. Why don't you meet Ippei Kuri?
Oh, I love how casual you are about that. My buddy who worked at Tatsunoko Pro. Was his name Ken Owashi?
Was it Ken the Eagle? Eagle. His name was Seven Zark Seven, and he said through some licensing arrangement with Sandy Frank, he was able to talk to Ippei Kuri.
Was it Sandy Frank who called you up? Hey, Patrick, it's me, Sandy. I'm just making that accent up. I have no idea what he sounds like.
Yeah, so Ippei Kuri was one of the co-creatives. I think at the very beginning of Tatsunoko Pro, it was his brother, Tatsuo Yoshida, who was kind of like the Jack Kirby of the group.
Okay.
But Ippei Kuri was drawing a lot of that early manga and stuff too. Like, I guess Tatsuo Yoshida, his brother, was like kind of the main creative on Speed Racer and Gatchaman. But then Tatsuo Yoshida sadly died very young in 1977, and Ippei Kuri kind of stepped into kind of front seat. And moving forward, like a lot of the artwork you see from Tatsunoko, like the Gatchaman movie poster from 78, Ippei Kuri drew that. And he was like an amazing draftsman. Like I have several art books where he's just drawing the Tatsunoko characters like Gatchaman or Tekkaman or Palomar, Yatterman. And it's this amazing synthesis of like American superhero comics and then like kind of like pre-manga Japanese pulp illustration.
Definitely. Gekiga, I'd call it, I think you'd
Gekiga.
Say.
Yeah.
Absolutely Gekiga. Gekiga being the kind of like style of manga that's aimed more at adolescents and young adults than the kind of Tezuka cartoony style. It came out in the late 60s and really revolutionized the entire manga industry. And yeah, Tatsunoko. So I actually heard this from an anime critic person here. And one of the big reasons that Tatsunoko was able to develop their style is the advent of a new kind of like tracing machine. There's a very specific device that was used in the anime industry in the 70s. And Tatsunoko was one of the first ones to get it. And it allowed them to kind of convey the Gekiga has like a much scratchier kind of cross-hatched look to it that was really difficult to capture in traditional anime. And I don't know if, Ippei Kuri or who was responsible for picking up these machines, but it really gave Tatsunoko a leg up, I think, on other studios in that early 70s timeframe. I think Gatchaman was the first thing they did with it, otherwise known as Battle of the Planets.
To me, Tatsunoko is like this missing link between kind of the children's animation era, like we see with the early Tezuka Osamu shows like Astro Boy and Kimba, and the kind of more harder-edged stuff like Yamato and Gundam. They had this love of action and adventure, and I have to say violence, that really pushed anime in that direction. And I don't know if we get to things like the bike chases in Akira without some of Speed Racer's DNA in there first.
It's funny you bring up that violence, and I don't mean it in a kind of salacious sort of way. The Tatsunoko stuff to me, especially from Gatchaman on, really a lot of it felt like almost movie-like, you know, something that you could imagine being done in real life. And I think even more than the Speed Racer to Akira connection, I honestly don't think you would have had the Sentai series without Gatchaman laying the groundwork for that. With like, you know, you have the five heroes, one of whom's a woman, you know, they got the tall guy, you got the fat guy, you know, each one's got their own machine. It really, even though it had nothing to do directly with Sentai, like the Power Rangers type stuff, it really, really, really laid the groundwork for that.
Wait, are you fat shaming Tiny, my favorite member of the G-Force?
You know, my problem with the G-Force was they dubbed over, what's his name? Keop? What is that? The kid?
Keop.
They dubbed him over with like Birdsong instead. He speaks in the Japanese version. He's like a furry or something in the English version. He can't even speak in English. Or human language. He speaks in bird language.
Yeah, I posted this interview that I did with Ippei Kuri in 2008 on my Substack in tribute of his passing. And he had this quote here where he says, "I like film and I like realism, but I always felt that it was hard for us at Tatsunoko to reach that level of detail in the anime style. Still, we tried our own way. I wanted to make things that were truly real, but they ended up the way they ended up. One of the results was Speed Racer." So to me, it's like that anime style was reaching for realism, but you can't get there because of time or because of money or whatever. But where you land, that is anime.
Well, I mean, anime is all about streamlining, you know, reality. It's all about, not only is it about design, but it's about replicable design, right? Like you can't have some character or some vehicle that's so complicated that you can't, you know, reliably draw it over and over again, week after week after week. But man, the design of the Mach 5, like all of those characters in Speed Racer, it's all so, so, so iconic. I know that Speed Racer wasn't the first anime to make it to American shores, but I think you can argue that it was the most kind of profoundly impactful, if that's a word. Do you agree with that?
I do. And the thing about Speed Racer that's kind of unusual is that it did okay in Japan, but it was a huge hit in the US globally, much bigger than in Japan. And I asked Ippei Kuri, I said, why do you think that is? Why do you think Speed had such a big life in the West? And well, he sort of like leaned back and sort of stroked his chin and said, the US had become a happy and prosperous nation after winning World War II, but all that began to change during the Vietnam era. The family unit started collapsing. People began protesting and criticizing their own government, but at that time, Speed Racer was still reflecting the image of the good old days.
Yeah, you know, I can agree with that, actually. America is a car society. I mean, this is why the first Japanese toy exports that came out, like, they were all tin toy cars or like plastic or metal cars, because the Japanese were obsessed with American vehicles. They saw them as a kind of symbol of success and, you know, made them for themselves and then exported them back to the Americans. So maybe Speed Racer has a little bit of that sort of, you know, Japanese fascination with American car culture in its DNA, even if there aren't any actual American cars in it. They're all pretty fantastic sports cars, as I recall. With like monkeys in the trunk, correct?
This is like one thing that always comes up when talking to like that older generation of like Japanese guys in like otaku industries, like toy designers and stuff, is they want to talk about supercars, sports cars, and this is kind of like, can't we just talk about Voltron?
Well, it's like when we met, remember when we met Katsushi Murakami, who was the ex, well now he's retired, I don't know, ex makes it sound like they kicked him out or something, which they didn't, he's retired, Bandai executive who founded, he was like the head designer of Popey, and you and I had dinner with him many years back now, probably a good 10. And I remember you and I, like, we were like, oh, let's talk about like Rydeen. We're gonna talk about Mazinger. All he wanted to talk about American Westerns and like the Ford Futura and American cars. That's all he wanted to talk about. And it was cool. But yes, there is that kind of obsession among that generation with American entertainment and vehicles.
Yeah, American lifestyle. Ipe Curry said, America made a great impression on us through the movies. After the war, we didn't have a washing machine, just a board on a bucket. Our living conditions were just awful. When we saw American home drama films, we saw electric appliances that everyone has now, but didn't exist in Japan at the time. When they opened the refrigerator, there were ready-made ice cubes inside, and people were making fancy cocktails. We felt nothing but longing for stuff like that.
You know, the irony is every time I go back to the States now, I'm like, I miss the amazing rock ice that they sell at 7-Eleven so I can make fancy cocktails with it. The only ice you can get in the States now is that crappy stuff that comes out of like the door of your refrigerator. I know, first world problems, but seriously.
And also you can't get a Slurpee here in Japan. You can go to a 7-Eleven in America. That's like the first thing I do. I stick my head under the nozzle and just pull.
When I'm in America, all I can think of is 7-Eleven ice cubes. And when I'm in Japan, all I can think of is 7-Eleven Slurpees. It's
a wacky world.
It's tough. But it's tough actually, on a serious note, losing people like this, because they're so key to having created like everything that we really love about Japan. I wasn't like a super Speed Racer or Gatchaman fan as a kid, but I can't imagine not having those works out there, because they're cool. They exude a certain cool factor that's really set them apart from Western stuff and even from Japanese stuff.
Yeah, I was crazy about Speed Racer and Battle of the Planets, you know, Gatchaman on American TV. I had just never seen animation be so dramatic. I mean, like the story between like Racer X and Speed was like played for maximum drama. The story about like Ken the Eagle and his dad, the secret agent in Red Impulse. Super, super dramatic stuff played to the hilt. Like just a maximum make a kid just go, oh my God, this never happened on Chilly Willy or Bugs Bunny.
No, and it felt there was a reality to it too. You know, that kind of like phone dial thing in the middle of the steering wheel, and like it was fantastic, but it was grounded in a sort of like, you felt like this as a kid, especially like, you know, this could really happen somewhere. Even if it did have that kind of Knight Rider sense of like, there's no crime that can't be solved without a fast car kind of thing. Like every happening in this world centers around, you know, speeding racers, as goes the title. Yeah, I unfortunately as a kid did not have access to these shows. Like Battle of the Planets and Speed Racer weren't shown in my area in the Washington, D.C. suburbs, or not at like times when I was easily able to watch it. So I was only able to like kind of catch them in, you know, either really snippets and reruns later on, or if like a friend had a tape or something like that when I was a little bit too old for them. So I'm jealous that you got to watch them at the proper age category for them.
Yeah, because they definitely primed me for the harder stuff like Yamato and Robotech and stuff like that.
And Orochi Doji.
And Orochi Doji, definitely. Another scene that made a big impression on me is when the Phoenix turns into the Fiery Phoenix, when their ship catches on fire to become like a super weapon.
That's the God Phoenix, factory.
And everyone in the cockpit is like screaming in pain, like they're being incinerated. And it's like, it's amazing that they would even willingly do this to themselves. Popeye never went through that level of physical torment when he ate spinach or anything like that.
Well, I was shocked that the Japanese version, as happens in so many cases, this is actually really true of a lot of anime that was localized for the West. Like Golion is much harsher than Voltron. And the Japanese Gatchaman, there are some dark, dark, dark subplots in there. Like the second in command guy gets like really badly injured in one of their missions. Like he gets like a piece of shrapnel stuck in his brain and it starts like affecting his personality. And like it's dark, dark stuff for like something that's made for kids. Like you say, there was literally nothing even remotely similar to that being, you know, made in the States or anywhere at that time, I don't think. Like in America, like the, you know, we did eventually get that kind of Ralph Bakshi kind of stuff, but it's sort of like fantasy oriented. And I don't know, Fritz the Cat, it's like, it doesn't really compare to this.
Well, those were age gated. Those were like rated R or rated X. This was for kids. This was literally shown in between old cartoons from the 1940s and like the New Zoo Review.
Well, it's crazy now because like the TV stations got them for cheap back then. Like, you know, you were able to like fill up your your slate, as it were, with a bunch of Japanese stuff. Like, you know, you'd get four or five Japanese shows for the price of one Bugs Bunny or Warner Brothers thing. And I think I don't know. I'm not a programmer at a television station these days, if such things exist. But I have a feeling the calculus is flipped. Now, like, the Japanese stuff is probably a lot more valuable than the, you know, now quite aging American stuff.
The availability and, like, the low cost it took to syndicate these things ensured that they traveled around the world.
Yes.
Like, my buddy who used to work at Tatsunoko, he was obsessed with, I think it's the Latin American version of Gatchaman called Commando Z. And to promote the theme song, they had these like five kids dressed up like Gatchaman singing this pop song on this variety show.
Patrick, please find that. Please find that clip. Please.
So those shows were shown all over the world. They reached, you know, every corner of the globe, much like Speed Racer himself.
This is one of the big differences between Japanese content of that kind of, if you want to call it, the golden era, the 60s, 70s, 80s, and today, which is back in time, Japanese creators like super undervalued their work. Like they didn't really push for lucrative, you know, deals in the licensing agreements. They didn't think it had that much value. But that ironically, like you said, allowed it to flourish around the globe because it was so cheap. It got out everywhere. It's kind of like, you know, to use a sort of adjacent example, you know, karaoke, the karaoke machine was never patented. So like you didn't have to pay any rights on it. And that's like a big reason why dozens of companies made it and karaoke went all over the world, or like emoji or something like that. Even though somebody created it, they didn't patent it. And so it was able to get all around. So like the irony is now Japanese creators are super, super, super aware of how, you know, valuable their work is. It's part of this like big Japan export strategy and blah, blah, blah. And it's probably tougher to acquire rights to Japanese things than it ever has been before. But like the whole cool factor was built up, I guess, on the first taste is free, even though I don't think any of them saw it that way. I don't think anybody like Ippei Kuri way back in the day imagined he was building this kind of cultural empire or contributing to the building of a cultural empire. But Speed Racer, man, it is a brick in that wall. I think you can definitely argue that.
Yeah, there's a quote from Ippei Kuri from the interview I did with him where he said, "We had such low expectations. After all, Speed Racer was a Japanese-created work, and America already had giant animation studios like Disney. The scale of what we were doing was so small by comparison. Still, the show broke through the wall to America, which was a huge deal for us, and it was continually on the air. On those terms, it was a major success." Yeah, that's the thing, is they didn't make any money from the global success of Speed Racer.
Right.
When they made the Hollywood movie, they got nothing except their name in the credits.
For Gigantor, I think they just literally gave the rights are still in the hands of the guy who made the English dub back in the 60s, like his production company. These were incredibly lopsided deals. And I'm not even blaming necessarily the Americans for making them. The Japanese willingly, they were so desperate to get their content sold and on the air in other places, get a little extra revenue, that they entered into these agreements willingly. But it's crazy. I mean, it's why we haven't seen, you know, Gigantor redone in the States or anything like that. It's still all in the hands of that one company.
Oh, but what about the Macross movie, Matt? What about Do You Remember Love?
Oh, we're not going to go into that morass of God. What is it? It's Harmony Gold? Is that who owns Robotech?
Sure is.
And then it's Tatsunoko, right? Who owns the Macross side, correct?
Big West.
Big West. No, but isn't Tatsunoko in there?
They used Tatsunoko Studios for some of the animation on that, as well as on Evangelion also was animated at Tatsunoko.
Well, you'd be surprised. Every time you look in the credits of a big film, you'll see like a ton of other studios besides the one that is, you know, credited with making it and releasing it, because they all need help. But, you know, I'm sure there's going to be Macross loving fans who are going to, you know, jump in into the, you know, comments and say, well, actually, but I just don't really follow that Mac. I watch whatever new Macross is out in Japan and I kind of ignore what's going on in the States. So sorry, sue me. But yes, Tatsunoko is still going on strong today, right? They're still making things. They're still getting out there. I mean, I know there's still like a couple of years ago, there was a new Taimbokan series out And Taimbokan is its own like thing that's huge in Japan, but I don't think any of those series were released in the States. I think they were in Europe.
Well, I think they were just maybe a few things were released on home video like during the anime boom, but like not right. televised. There's like no awareness of that. More people know Yatterman through the Miike movie, the live action movie.
Right. Miike made that. And that was like a, you know, a kind of classic series back in the 70s where you had this kind of dominatrix as the antagonist character. And like she would get her clothes ripped off in seemingly every episode. It's like people still talk about that today. It's just like, man, like you could get away with anything back then.
Yeah, Tatsunoko is still around. They're still out there. They do a lot of licensing. Every now and then they'll do a reboot of a classic series. Doesn't like Takara Tomy, I think, owns part of the studio now or something?
I mean, it would make sense that they're doing it in the same way that, like, you know, Bandai owns, you know, a big chunk of Sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
I think they actually own Sunrise. But yeah, you know, it's funny. I mainly think of Tatsunoko these days as being like, I know they did a lot of co-productions, like you said, like Evangelion and things like that, and like helping out in the background. But I mainly know, I mean, because they did a lot, and I mean a lot, not just Macross, but like Mospita, you know, they did.
All the Robotech shows, yeah, were partially animated at Tatsunoko.
But I mainly think of Tatsunoko today as being more associated with the live action remakes of their stuff. Like there's that Kashan movie that came out about, what is it, 10, 15 years back now?
Yeah, there was a live action Gatchaman movie that I'd already forgotten about.
Oh yeah, wow, I totally forgot about that. And then they did that, wasn't there this, like, I remember in the teens, that there was like some weird, like Gatchaman reboot that was like a comedy? It was like Gatchaman, what, like Crowds. Gatchaman Crowds,
yeah.
Yes.
That was Tatsunoko.
And it was like set in Tachikawa, which is like, you know, this like really suburban, neighborhood city kind of thing about, I don't know, half an hour away from Shinjuku. Very local.
I kept waiting for them to go into God Phoenix mode in Tachikawa and whenever I'm there, and it just never seems to happen.
Everybody screaming in the building. Actually, that links into the whole thing of like, why do people who pilot mecha in Japan feel the pain when their mecha is hit? Like Zinger Z.
Yeah, why does pain suddenly appear every time you are near?
But, you know, seriously, it's a sad day when any animator goes off to that great animation studio in the sky. And I'm very, very sad to see Ippei Kuri go. I'm surprised more has not been made of this. I guess probably because it wasn't really announced until many weeks after he had passed. But Godspeed, Ippei Kuri. You are awesome.
Well, Matt, that about wraps it up for episode 53 of the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. Want to thank everyone for listening and supporting our show.
Yes. And please also read and support our newsletters. Mine is blog.pureinventionbook.com. Patrick, what is yours?
Mine is tokyoscope.blog.
Well, yours is easier to remember than mine. But I forgive you. I forgive you. And I forgive everyone who hasn't subscribed to both of these.
It's not too late. Don't delay. Do it today.
Thank you for listening. It's always awesome to do this. And I'll catch you next week.
See you next time. Bye.